turned up today. I'm happy to introduce Kishwa Faulkner, Baroness Faulkner, who was the first Muslim woman to join the House of Lords in 2004, right?
Second.
2007.
No, second Muslim woman. Paula Udin was the first.
See? So I've got that wrong.
The internet does not always tell the truth.
But you did join the House of Lords in 2004, and Baroness Faulkner is a Liberal Democrat and has worked for the Liberal Democrats in European politics for many years prior to becoming a fast-moving fixture in British politics. Kishwa was educated at a Catholic convent school in Karachi, Pakistan, and has a degree from the London School of Economics, and is very active today in civil liberties, in questions about international relations and human rights, and has been spending the year, now almost a year, here in Boston, was teaching at the Kennedy School in the fall, and I now think that you're pretty much teaching on airlines, actually. certainly, I have been extraordinarily happy to see Kishwa come here to Boston. I've known Kishwa for some years, since we first met in London, and I think you can all look forward to a very exciting event here for a couple of hours over your lunch. So welcome, Kishwa.
Thank you, Jutta. Jutta was noticing how I was tucking into the excellent lunch you're giving me, and I explained to her that it's because it's the first proper meal I've had in about 4 days, travelling from London to Spain and then back from Spain to Boston, which was an adventure in itself. So, but Andalusia was worth it. Thank you for coming in such good numbers on such a beautiful day. I said to Eric that I'll talk about Western Muslims in particular, concentrating on the United Kingdom. But I will, if it comes up, touch on other countries in Europe as well, although I recognize the expert in that area sitting to my left. And we'll throw in some observations about the United States, if I could be so bold as to do that too. So just to put things into context, in Europe we have about 15 to 20 million Muslims. The figures are imprecise because there's still many European countries that don't include religion on census data, so we can't really know. In Britain, we do include that question, and in 2001, we were found to have 2.67 million Muslims. And 1.67 million Muslims, which is about 2.5% of the population. Thinking is that that figure is probably higher because it was the first time the question was asked in the census, and there were many people who at that point weren't prepared to identify with any religious group, but that things have now moved on and the next census that will take place will probably have a higher figure, as well as demographic changes. Now, a couple of definitional issues. First, I think I'd like to differentiate between Muslims, Islamism as political Islam, and naturally to distinguish terrorism from either of those first two categories. Now, I see the first, which is just Muslims as ordinary citizens who may or may not be pious, just like others in society. Political Islam takes a philosophical and ideological position, which on the whole represents a conservative and often authoritarian mindset, whereby the interpretation of the religion is both on the one hand more narrow, and on the other hand its approach is broader than that used by other Muslims. It's more narrow in the sense that it is a more narrow interpretation, a much more literalist interpretation, and it's broader in the sense that it sees the interpretation as the only authentic one being its interpretation, and is one that should be adhered to by all of us in the broader co-religionist sphere. So it allows less scope for dissent, and its objectives are usually directed at political ends. Terrorism, for the purposes of this talk, is where premeditated acts of violence lead to mass numbers of civilian casualties. I really do want to distinguish it, but and I did think about whether I wanted to include it in here, but I had no doubt that it would come up in the discussion, so I thought I might as well address it right up front. Now, there seems to be a genuine perspective here in the United States that Muslims in the United Kingdom and in other European countries are on the whole extremist, that on the whole we're sympathetic to terrorists, and that we're alienated from mainstream culture, whether that culture is French or British or whatever. There is also a perception that Muslims here on the US, on the other hand, are, you know, a better type, that yours are rather better than the ones we've got. And at the same time, there is a real contradiction here, because if you listen to, there is that smugness, as I might call it, on the one hand, and then on the other hand, if you listen to reactionary, you know, more of the right-wing media, then you suddenly discover that they're equally as suspect, in fact, far more suspect than we who, where we are perhaps slightly more sensitive and mindful of other people's sensibilities, secular, more secular than we might be, that in many cases here, that the attitude towards Muslims is far worse. And I find that contradiction a very interesting one in the United States. But the one thing that equates across both systems is that we're seen as a thing apart from the mainstream. So where does reality lie? I think in the United Kingdom, the main issues that you look at here are that we can break things down into possibly differences in the different generations. So the first generation of Muslims who came over to the United Kingdom in the 50s and 60s were unskilled from agrarian backgrounds and came to work in industries and in smokestack industries on the whole and do jobs that other people in Britain with the economic post-war boom weren't really prepared to do. So we see, looking at that generation, we see socioeconomic factors that result in second generational poverty and second generation social exclusion through very poor educational and economic outcomes. Then you have the second generation who were born in the United Kingdom. They don't take kindly to newspaper articles telling them to get on a plane and go home, because their homes are indeed Bradford and Leeds and Rochdale and Birmingham and London. Their issues are more to do with, on the one hand, the socioeconomics they inherited from their parents, but then on the other hand, to do with growing up as a visible minority, where race plays a cogent part of their experience, very seldom touched upon, incidentally, and that's an interesting question as to why Muslims use the race empowerment struggles so much less than you would expect us to in the way that we interact with the state and fight for equality and non-discrimination. And then the other factor that is becoming more evident with them is that they clearly see their religion in light as a very potent identification factor in terms of who they are vis-a-vis the rest of society, thereby the visible symbols of appearance, representation, distinguishing themselves as Muslims through dress and the wearing of beards and so on. The second and third, now there is already in the United Kingdom an emerging third generation of Muslims. And the second and third generations are the people we most clearly identify with alienation and in some few limited cases with extremism. It is not on the whole a problem to do with the first generation. So older people on the whole seem to think, when you ask them in polls, that their experience of the United Kingdom is on the whole positive. They believe that their lives have been better in the United Kingdom and that it is a good place. In other words, their loyalty is stronger across the first generation than those who were actually born in the country. I should say, by means of background, as Yuta has pointed out, that not only was I born in Pakistan, so I'm a first generation myself, but I, in fact, I'm rare among British parliamentarians in that I grew up in a Muslim majority country. And I'm very clear in terms of self-reflection that my experiences are based on the fact that I didn't experience some of the race and alienation that clearly younger people do. And I am tempered by their experience. My views are tempered by their experience. I think they have a much harder time than somebody like me did. Now, given this background, and there's been a lively debate in the United Kingdom at selective soul-searching about models of integration, about whether multiculturalism, the model followed from the 1960s onwards, has failed Britain, and so on. And there's been quite a lot of sort of anger, particularly more palpable, started with 9/11, but became much more palpable after what we call our 7th of July 2005 public transport bombings. But I think now, looking at where the debate is in the UK, it has actually moved on. And that's encouraging. It's moved on in the sense that whereby people like me, who are not particularly religious, I'm more something that Jewish people would understand when I say that I'm a secular Muslim, or I describe myself also as a cultural Muslim. I'm not a pious Muslim in any regard, but I have because I grew up in a Muslim-majority country, in fact a very pious Muslim family, I have great sympathy with the debates, but I am very clear that I'm no Muslim leader in the sense of having any theological credentials at all. People like me were rather rarer about 5 years ago, and the very example of the debate has moved on. We were in those days referred to as moderate Muslims or progressive Muslims, something that I always eschewed. I found rather patronizing. What is very interesting now is that we are forming more and more of the mainstream, and we're not given this title any longer. We're just described as Muslims. In other words, there are more who look and act and speak like this rather than the ones that the media first made into monsters. And that's in itself, to me, an indication that the debate has moved on. So in public policy, though, it's now also more broadly accepted that there were issues to do with the model of multiculturalism, and that the left failed through policies that approached different communities as in silos and, you know, left them to do their own thing, made no effort to integrate them into broader society. Spatial segregation, poor education, poor housing as a result of spatial segregation, and a rather paternalistic approach on the part of the state, as I put it the other day, a sort of take me to your leader colonial expression of these are different people and we'll just let them get on and do their own thing. As long as they're two or three people, we can use as interlocutors between them and us. That approach, I think, has been recognized. And there is a genuine attempt to move on from that approach. Then on the right, there is a recognition that the debate needs to become more constructive. And that recognition, I think there's, and I say, I believe it is really a genuine recognition. I see the Conservative Party in the United Kingdom as really having moved to the centre ground on this issue. And I think this recognition has come from the rather belated other recognition that when you have the extremism residing in greater numbers in people who are now third generation citizens of the country, then they're not going to go on a plane and get on a plane and go elsewhere. They're going to very much live as part of the society, so we might as well bring them in and interact with them rather than lecturing and hectoring them to get better or else. The state has very few solutions in terms of or else, and the right is beginning to recognize that as well. So we're seeing a more nuanced discussion about the role of Muslims as active citizens and about the role of the state, which guarantees equality and non-discrimination, but now stands back from overt social engineering. So in this sense, I mean, I want to read to you a couple of statistics to show you where the debate is, but how easily it can be moved apart. About 2 months ago, a slightly right-wing think tank called the Policy Exchange in the United Kingdom did a study called Living Apart Together, British Muslims and the Paradox of Multiculturalism. Now, all the newspaper headlines that this study generated were how alienated Muslims still were and how they weren't really, you know, there wasn't any social cohesion with the rest of society, and they weren't coming together. Yet, when I actually read the report, its findings were, as usual, rather different. So, you know, there were some surprising findings. Some of the surprising findings were that, for example, 21% of Muslims have consumed alcohol. Now, this is very interesting, because if 21% are prepared to say that they defy one of the strictest taboos in the religion, then I suspect the figure is rather higher. Not that I'm suggesting, lest you get the wrong impression, that consuming alcohol is in any respect a good thing. I'm not making any judgment on that, but I'm just saying to you how they've moved away from perhaps a strict literalist interpretation of Wahhabi Islam by living in the West. 65% have paid interest on a normal mortgage. That is, again, you know, in Islam, usury and paying interest is forbidden. Yet 65%, and we have financial tools available to have Islamic mortgages, yet 65% are perfectly happy to just go down the high street, speak to the local bank manager and borrow in the high street. 20% have gambled. Again, shocking. And 10% have admitted to taking drugs. Now, I don't say any of these things with any joy at all, but if, you know, if we take on some of the ills of wider society, then that surely shows that we are very open to taking on the better values of wider society. And in terms of better values, there were a good amount. You know, they believe, despite, for example, it says, despite widespread concerns about Islamophobia, 84% of Muslims believe they have been treated fairly in this society. And again, surprisingly, 28% believe that the authorities in Britain go over the top in trying not to offend Muslims. In other words, 28%, of which I count myself as one, and again I say the figure is rather higher, believe that the state has actually, through its policies, encouraged a feeling of victimhood among Muslims, among Muslim groups. You know, I'll give you two examples that I thought were particularly revealing. 75% thought it was wrong for a local council to have banned an advertisement for a Christmas carol service. So a local authority mistook their views and banned a carol service at Christmas. 75% of Muslims actually didn't agree with that. I thought that was wrong. 64% believed it was wrong for a council, local authority meaning council, to have banned all images of pigs from its offices. I'm actually surprised that's as low as 64%. I would have expected it to be 94% of these. You know, if you were relaxed about symbols of social, well, of animal rights, for example, Britain is a society very committed to animal rights. In fact, images of all animals proliferate across offices. If you look at boards of, you know, postcards and things, you're more likely to find animals, cats and dogs and pigs and humans. So I found that amazing. I think that's very good news. Another thing, Muslims again themselves are speaking out about how they don't want to be seen as a cohesive bloc. So 75% believe there's more diversity and disagreement within the Muslim populations than other people realize. And they're crying out for that to be brought out in the open. So to come back, so I think that there is good news. The debate is truly moving on. And for me, this exemplifies the fact that, this report exemplifies the fact that Muslims are actually becoming more engaged. They're becoming more active as citizens. I'm conscious you're... I've only got a few minutes left. Shall I start?
This is your okay. Table, so keep going on. All right.
Now, one of the other examples we have of new organized, of greater interaction, you know, you come, very often things in life, there is a sense of abject sort of depression. After 7/7, we felt like that in the UK. We had, some of us had felt like that after 9/11, but after what happened to us itself, there were many of us who said, it's just going to be awful from now on. But in fact, on the other hand, you know, there are always clouds, silver linings in clouds. And the silver lining that I saw very early on when this happened was that there were two things that could have happened to the Muslim community. It could have pulled the covers over its head and hidden away. Or it could have found that it needed to engage, that it hadn't done a terribly good job of displaying its own loyalty to its country, of bringing up its children as well as it might have, and it has clearly gone for the latter option and decided to engage more broadly. So one of the new things, one of the new developments in the last 3 years has been there have been a plethora of new organizations that are starting to reflect the diversity of opinions among Muslims. I mean, some of them have some rather odd-sounding names, like Radical Middle Way. Well, as a liberal, I always called myself radical. I never called myself in the middle. So I knew that I couldn't have both. But, you know, we have Radical Middle Way. We have Muslims for a Secular Britain. That's a new interesting development, led by a very prominent female journalist. We have the Muslim Sufi Council, so they're denominating themselves in terms of different sectarian aspects as well. We have Muslim Youth Helpline, which when asked why it's set up as a helpline, you know, why the problems of youth are all similar, the answer they gave me, a wonderful organization, I'm very fond of them, said they are similar. Problems are exactly the same as across other society. You know, sexual relations, drugs, parental problems, peer group pressures, all of the usual stuff you find in teenagers. But the difference is, the reason we've got to have the appellate of Muslim, the difference is that kids define their relations with their parents differently in these cultures than in white mainstream cultures. And by having that, they're more likely to ring us and get a sympathetic hearing. Whereas, you know, if you rang up, if you're a pregnant 16-year-old and rang up the standard youth helpline in London, and they might even say to you, have you thought talking to your mother about it? Well, a Muslim girl couldn't necessarily talk to her mother about it. Her mother may simply be impotent to deal with the issues, so because of the dominance of males in society. So, you know, they're doing good stuff, and they're doing valuable work. South Asian Women's Helpline, Arab Women's Helpline, it's amazing the number of organizations that are cropping up, and it's a very good thing. And what is also interesting is that they're not raising money abroad. They're not raising money through dubious sources, these charities. They're raising money in mainstream Britain. I stood on the street with the Muslim Youth Helpline in the area of London in which they operate, on the street on a Saturday morning with a treadle stable, and I've had people across British society putting the £5, the £2 into our box. And that's a good thing, because if we're creating a problem with society, society also has to understand that it needs to engage with our problems, and that's been very good. I think the final point I'll make is that the security agenda has also been recognized as being distant, different, and discrete from the rest of the interaction. So whereby the Labour government, Mr. Blair, in the beginning since 9/11, more or less, new terrorism legislation came in, and Mr. Blair himself took the position that, you know, on the one hand, he would say, I know there's nothing wrong with Islam. I know that Islam is a peaceful religion. But we are going to bring in this legislation, which will really impact on civil liberties, and it will really profile people and things like that. But on the other hand, Islam is peaceable, which was completely contradictory. I think the state has now recognized, and the agents of the state have now recognized, that the terrorism agenda is a different agenda. The security agenda is very different from the rest of society and social cohesion and ordinary law and order. Now, Muslims who reacted against that terrorism agenda, saying we're all being cast as terrorists and they're profiling us, stopping and searching us, lots of other things, have now also come to realize that actually the state has a legitimate interest in defending the security of its citizens. And so they will occasionally have to be unpleasant laws passed. And maybe the thing to do is interact in the early stages of advocacy to make those laws better laws than to simply beat one's chest and say, oh, we're the victims. So it's been, on the whole, I'm very optimistic, and I'll just end on that note to say that I think that we are moving on, and it's becoming a very interesting debate.